morning and welcome to Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. How are you?
So after a week of incredible volatility and substantial carnage on Wall Street, markets today are again fluctuating wildly. We'll be keeping an eye on that during this morning's program. We'll also be spending some time in the program with Will Thompson, a financial advisor, and sort of get his take on what's going on and how it fits into historical conditions. We're going to start our hour, however, with Jonathan Tarleton. His book, Homes for Living, is about some cooperatives in New York City called Mitchell Llama. Really interesting interview. The Mitchell Llama program, named after a couple of legislators who created the program, which was an affordable housing program, but that offered the potential for the owners of the cooperative to go private. We'll hear all about it. The issue of affordable housing continues to be one of the biggest challenges facing us in the Wasatch Back and the rest of the nation. Today we're going to take a look at one way the issue of ownership collides with the role of government in supporting affordable housing. In his new book, Homes for Living, author Jonathan Tarleton explores how two different New York cooperatives approach the issue of privatization of publicly supported housing. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning and thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Jonathan, what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take to do the research?
Yeah, thank you. So I've been following the stories at the core of this book for about a decade, on and off. You know, the research probably cumulatively took about 5 years, but it's an ongoing story. I came to it first as a journalist. So I was working in New York City on planning and housing related issues, and a resident of one of these cooperatives approached me about these privatization debates that were happening in the building. So that was my initial introduction. I also am trained as an urban planner. So as I dug into these stories, I was very interested in part because this housing is one of the U.S.'s best example of really successful social housing efforts. And so I was interested in, you know, what were the issues related to preserving that housing, to making sure that these affordable, safe, stable homes were able to remain as such for future generations. And then, you know, it's hard not to just get sucked into these stories. One of the things that I always wanted to do in the book was center people. Too many of the housing conversations we have they're about numbers of units, they're about area median income, affordability levels, they're about, you know, what a rent costs. And ultimately, you know, these stories, homes are about, you know, the people who live in them. And I have a background as an oral historian as well, and so I enjoy doing deep interviewing and getting to speak to these folks over the course of many years was just such a blessing and quite fun.
So let's start with some basics. In order for the audience to understand what we're talking about, I think we got to start with what a co-op is, because that's not necessarily a concept. It's all that, well, certainly we don't see those here in Utah. Well, how does a co-op, from an ownership perspective, just a co-op work in New York City?
Yeah, great question. So co-ops are somewhat similar to condos. The distinction being in a condo situation, a person physically owns a space and part of a larger, you know, multifamily building. In a co-op, the entire building is owned by a company. So the resident owners of that co-op own a share in that company. And that share gives them and entitles them to an apartment in the building, as well as a role in the governance of that building. So, you know, your share entitles you to a vote for the co-op board. That co-op board, you know, manages building operations, finances, what have you. But the co-ops in this book are kind of a subset of that larger genre or model of co-op. So these co-ops are called limited equity co-ops, which refer to the fact that there's a resale restriction on that share. So in a, you know, in many co-ops in New York City, the very, very fancy ones you will hear of lining Central Park, An owner of one of those shares or a resident of the co-op can sell for whatever they want to. But in a limited equity co-op, the resale value of that share is capped in order to keep it affordable to middle and lower income residents over a long period of time. So in this case, folks were able to buy into these co-ops at very, very low prices. You know, even today, somebody could, if they come in off the wait list for these apartments for these co-ops, could buy, a home in Lower Manhattan for as little as $45,000, which is somewhat unheard of. But if they want to leave, if they want to sell, they basically get what they put in plus inflation back. They're not profiting off of any appreciation of the value of the home because these were designed to be permanent and to be affordable in perpetuity.
And again, just to give us the big picture, the way that these kinds of buildings came to be in this program, I think it's called Mitchell Llama, the government obviously played a role in financing the building in the first place. How did it work from a big picture?
Yeah, so this was an extremely successful New York State and New York City program it began in the mid-1950s, was funding and building apartments through the early 70s. As you said, government played a major role here. They provided the mortgages on the building, in some cases up to 95% of the actual project costs. They provide ongoing tax abatements to these buildings, even today. So the property taxes on Mitchell Llama buildings are significantly less than a comparable apartment building elsewhere in the city. And they also oversee these buildings to some extent. I mean, I should be clear, these are private entities. Like I said before, these co-ops are private companies, but they serve a public purpose, and they are in many ways rewarded for serving that public purpose by this ongoing government support, this ongoing public support for the model. It's a big program. So there were almost 140,000 apartments in New York City alone built through these programs. About half of those were these limited equity co-ops. The other half were rentals, and there are kind of some key distinctions between those different models, the rental and the co-op model. But the co-ops in the book have received, the significant public support over the last 50 or 60 years, and many continue to do so today.
So now, are the co-ops partially owned by the city government, meaning they can rent them out as rent control?
No, so these are entirely privately owned. The role that the government, the city and state still hold in the operations of these co-ops is, they essentially act as a backstop. There are rules around, say, how does someone get an apartment in these co-ops? So, there's a wait list. If you want to add your name to the wait list, you have to meet certain income restrictions. So these were built as middle-income housing. So there is, you have to make below a certain amount of money in order to qualify to add yourself to the wait list. They make sure that, in some cases, and there's a mixture of, as you can imagine, there's a mixture of opinions on how helpful different regulatory agencies are in this. But, they make sure that these co-ops are getting decent deals on big contracts. So, one of the co-ops in this book is 1,000, almost 1,400 apartments. So it's huge. I mean, there are over 4,000 people living in this co-op. There's a lot of money involved. They have to replace the boilers. They have to, replace the roof over time. And the city and state regulatory agencies will look over those contracts to ensure that, everything is on the up and up. So there's that sort of ongoing relationship with the city regulatory agencies, but the city and state do not own any portion of it.
Which kind of takes us to the story. Given the nature of this program, it wouldn't be intuitively obvious to me that the people who created it would contemplate a time in which the buildings could essentially go private and try to turn these into market units. How did the potential for privatization come about?
Yeah, so I should say in the original law that created this program, privatization was not even possible. So it was a change to the law in a number of years after the program was created that allowed for this possibility. And this is a really key part of this story because the intention of the change, which the change itself was, once these buildings pay off their mortgage, they can go through a process of voting whether or not to retain these resale restrictions on the units. If they vote to remove those, you know, the shares can be sold for, you know, quote unquote, whatever the market can bear. That change was intended to incentivize more rental development under the program. And that does make conceptual sense, and it did have that effect, because if you have a developer, you know, again, we're talking about rentals now, not co-ops. If you have a developer who builds, you know, a big rental building, and, you know, 20 or 30 years down the line, they can remove the restrictions on the rents, they stand to make a lot more money. So they are essentially incentivized to build more of these buildings to begin with. That doesn't work on the co-op side, in part because the developer builds the building and then immediately sells it to all of the residents. So none of the residents really stand to benefit. You know, the residents aren't going to be going out and building more, you know, 1,400 unit buildings. They are just living there. So this change was sort of misapplied. This change that was intended to spur rental development was misapplied to co-ops. And so this essentially a loophole was opened up. You know, it's important to note that even though that loophole existed for many years, it wouldn't have made any sense for an actual resident owner of these places to privatize, in part because, you know, New York City has obviously changed a significant amount over the last 50 or 60 years. In the 70s, 80s, you know, these were, first of all, the best deal in town. They were super quality, very stable housing situations. They were affordable. And there was no real massive profit upside to be made if they removed that resale restriction. That changes when, you know, the value of real estate in New York just completely skyrockets in the ensuing decades. So that kind of profit motive enters the equation, and residents sort of have to start wrestling with this. Well, you know, do we want to leave the program? If we leave the program, we lose all of that public support. You know, the tax breaks go away. There are all sorts of sort of a domino of effect that raise the costs for the actual building. But it also would allow for residents to, you know, some of whom bought in for as little as $3,000 in the 1970s to potentially sell an apartment for $1 million today. So that is the kind of core tension in these debates. And on its face, you may say, well, with a profit motive like this, wouldn't this be done and dusted? Like, wouldn't everyone just choose to quote unquote privatize? And it's simply not the case. These debates are super tight. They are incredibly fraught, in part because these are really tight-knit communities. And there are really good reasons why people would want to remain in the program and forego that potential profit, even good financial reasons. So,
now, can they hand these down to family?
So it's a complex question, in part because so it is possible for family members to hand it down, but they have to be living in the same apartment. But there are, you know, there are in many cases like three generations of family members living in these buildings now. And the mechanism by which those, some people call them quote unquote dynasties, which these lineages are able to kind of grow in a one co-op together is through this waitlisting system. So there's kind of there's that external waitlist. This is new people coming into the development. There's also an internal waitlist. So if you are, say, I'm living there with my mom, I'm older, I want to move out, I can get on an internal waitlist, which is essentially a faster track And get access to an apartment, you know, a number of years down the line. And so there is less of, there's less passing down the apartment to, say, family, but there are all of these different mechanisms by which families can really grow within a co-op.
And the dynasty comes from the fact that you have one family that will own a dozen apartments, and therefore they have a bigger voting right than a single apartment, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's a great point. There are, these debates play out in the context of co-op governance. So as you're noting, like, there are these co-op boards that are making these decisions. And so the elections around the boards become very significant. And in fact, you know, you end up with more or less little political parties within the co-ops running slates of candidates specifically on the privatization issue. There are folks in the book. One guy in the book, his name is Jacob Villa. Like, he's coordinating with his cousin, with his parents, with his sister, who all live in this building and are part of this kind of complex, you know, in some ways, political machination to push the co-op decisions in one way or another.
So let's get to the core of the story, which really is about this debate over privatization. And can you describe a little? Let's start with Southbridge, which is, as I understand it, ultimately decides not to privatize. With that, hope that's not considered a spoiler.
Southbridge does, but it's totally
I'm
fine.
Sorry, I got it backwards. St. James does not. Southbridge does decide to privatize. Yeah. How would you characterize the arguments for and against, and the two camps that supported them?
Yeah, it's a great question, and this there's a lot of richness here. So,
yes.
The against is the easier to explain. One is that this is a public good. This housing is a public good that has been supported by the city. It's been supported by our neighbors through this, you know, public subsidy over many years. And that we are stewards of that housing, and therefore we should not be able to profit from it, that we should maintain it for future beneficiaries like us, like families like us who, you know, couldn't, you know, buy somewhere else. You know, we should essentially pass this on. So that's the sort of more moral or ethical argument around why maintaining this as a Mitchell-Ama is important. There's also a key financial argument as well. As I was mentioning, when these co-ops, if they privatize, they lose that public subsidy. So they lose tax abatements. They also lose access to cheap forms of financing that the city and state provide. So, you know, these buildings are 50, 60 years old now. They have significant capital needs. So they have to borrow money in order to meet those needs, like any big apartment building would need to do. But these co-ops are able to tap into extremely low interest rates that are provided by government. So that opportunity goes away. And the argument for them is, if we privatize and we lose all that subsidy, over time, this place is actually going to become more expensive for us. Even the folks who are living there right now, if you want to stay living in these places, then it doesn't actually make sense. Like, yes, your apartment has more value, but if you're trying to stay, your monthly costs are going to go up over time. So those are the arguments against. For, there's the obvious profit motive. So there's the idea of, well, I could make a bunch of money this way. I could realize, you know, a very American push to, quote unquote, build wealth through housing. That's needless to say that people are building wealth through this housing in other ways by being able to save. But there's that profit motive. There's also a real sense of entitlement to that profit. And that's constructed in a number of different ways. So one of those arguments is that, you know, we moved here. We built this community. Like, we created this value. And it's an interesting argument, in part because they have created value in the community. There's no doubt they are the community. Many of these people on either side of the debate have poured so much into their neighborhoods. They're, you know, volunteering on tons of boards. They're doing all kinds of things. But the fact of the matter is that the like massive amount of money that's involved here is not, you know, is not coming out of their personal endeavors. It's coming out of, you know, the public put a lot of money up for this through government. You know, the market has changed dramatically. It's not, you know, I volunteered in my community and therefore now my apartment is worth $1 million. Like that's not quite how it works. So there is an entitlement there. There's also this real argument that if I am not able to sell the apartment for whatever I want, then that's not true homeownership. And this is a really interesting argument in part because, you know, as we know, looking across the history of housing and housing booms, housing busts in the U.S., you know, ownership of housing does not always end up in profit. It also ends up in the opposite and not an insignificant portion of the time. But there's this real kind of sense of like what the quote unquote American dream is that like, I can't achieve that unless I am able to sell my home for whatever, you know, whatever I can get. So that's another argument. And then there is an argument that this was intended. So I mentioned earlier the kind of loophole that was created in the Mitchell-Lama law that allowed this privatization to take place. And there is a narrative that is, it is incorrect, but it is very common that this is what the policymakers intended to do. And that's, it's just not the case. But it's very, it
sounds like a very self-serving narrative.
It is. I mean, you know, these debates, they are awash in disinformation and misinformation that mirror our wider political debates in many ways. And it is a very self-serving narrative. And it's something that, like, you know, now over the generations, you know, parents have told their children. It's like it's become part of lore almost among some families is that this is what was always intended. And that's not true. But it is a very powerful argument for people who want to say, yeah, so maybe this does get rid of affordable housing in New York City and affordable housing is important. But that was the point. You know, and so they can kind of absolve themselves in that way by saying this was a policy intention. So those are some of the core arguments. There are many more. And, you know, as with housing in the U.S., you can't really talk about housing without talking about race in a lot of cases. And that's two big differences between these co-ops. You know, Southbridge is a predominantly white co-op. St. James is a predominantly black co-op. And there are, you know, really different experiences or ways of experience or way of looking at what this housing means, both within those co-ops, but also across, you know, white folks and black folks and other people of color.
The book is very rich with the stories about how these campaigns, I mean, both of these co-operators had to go through a series of votes in order to make the decision as to whether to privatize or not. And the book is rich with stories about many of the characters, which is really a wonderful part of the story. But I guess what we need to do is, obviously, as you've indicated, Southbridge ultimately votes to privatize. Why did privatization fail at St. James? How did that community view the world differently?
This was sort of one of the central things I was trying to tease out as I looked at these debates. Is like, how did, you know, what was the fork in the road here? To draw lessons on how we can preserve these in the future. I think one of the differences comes down to tactics among groups. So I mentioned, you know, you mentioned that there are these very intense campaigns that are all surrounding the series of three votes that the co-ops have to go through in order to effectuate privatization. And those three votes, they're quite complex because all of this is run through the lens of securities law. It's basically treated as if you're doing an offering of shares of a company, which is in effect what you are doing. But that means that residents are tasked with making sense of these plans, these financial projections and assessments that in many cases end up being 600 or 700 pages long. So there are these massive tomes of complex information. it really matters how the groups that are for or against privatization talk about it in public, because at the end of the day, very few people are actually going to read that 600-page complex document. At Southbridge, the public arguments ended up being very, very financial, almost exclusively. Mm. And I think this was ultimately a mistake on the part of the folks who were trying to preserve it, but it was, they ended up making largely financial arguments, because every time they brought up these questions of, well, should we really be essentially privatizing this public asset? Should we be profiting from this public subsidy that has gone into creating this infrastructure over a long period of time? Every time they brought up that question, they got branded as being quote unquote ideological. And they sort of got shut down in that way. And obviously there's ideology on both sides of this, but they were the only ones that were considered ideological. And so they stopped making those moral arguments. They stopped making those ethical arguments. There was also a lot less outside support in the Southbridge debates. So there are, you know, there's some citywide advocacy groups in New York City focused on these co-ops because, you know, as I was mentioning, there's so many. But the folks arguing, you know, for staying in Mitchell-Ama at Southbridge, they didn't want to be publicly associated with those external groups, in part because there was this real knee-jerk response against quote-unquote outsiders being involved. So it was like, you don't want to bring those people in, you know, internally. They don't live here. This is not their decision. Even though this really is a decision, though it is one that's put up to these cooperators, it's a decision, a public decision about a public asset. And that's another reason that, you know, local politicians didn't really get involved at Southbridge, in part because it's such a big voting block. You know, this is over 4,000 people who live there. They didn't really want to touch this. So there was often a lot of conversation about, well, this is their decision. They're a co-op. It's a democratic enterprise. You know, we'll support whatever the decision that the residents come to. But that sort of like stepped back on the, you know, making the public argument about why this kind of housing is really important, not just for the residents of the co-op, but for all New Yorkers, for it remaining a place that, you know, middle and lower income people have an affordable place to live. At St. James, there was a very different approach. One, you know, they still made these financial arguments, but they also made the moral ones. Local politicians were very involved. There was also a different kind of relationship with the larger neighborhood that I think is really important. So at Southbridge was built in Lower Manhattan when Lower Manhattan was basically all commercial. It was one of the few residential developments downtown. And so they always had this view of themselves as being sort of, they called themselves pioneers. they had this view of themselves as being us sort of against the neighborhood, or like we're out here on our own. So there's a bit of insularity there, and it even shows up in kind of the design of the buildings. St. James, there was much more connection with the neighborhood. So, you know, residents of St. James, many of which are Black families, they looked out on the wider neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant and Clinton Hill that they're a part of. They saw that, you know, families like theirs no longer being able to afford to live there. They saw them being pushed out. And they looked at their own situation and said, well, some of them looked at their own situation and said, oh, like we're insulated from this. Like this structure, this limited equity co-op structure is allowing us to stay here when our friends and family who live elsewhere in the neighborhood in different housing situations can't. So it is incumbent on us to preserve this. And so I think that was a really, you know, potent argument, and it just, you know, touched people in a way that their lives, you know, it was very tied up in their personal lives in a way that Southbridge, which wasn't as connected with the wider neighborhood, did not. So that's a very Spark Notes version of it, but there are a lot of different, very interesting dynamics around why one co-op chose one way and the other co-op chose the other.
Now, coming up to the end of the book, you refer to a statement that ownership is the first real step in becoming a person of economic substance. You assert this you assert that this is perhaps best read as an assessment of the illness that such a conception of ownership brings. Can you explain that a bit, please?
Yeah, no, thank you. So this was a quote from a resident at St. James Towers who was, he was for privatization. And part of his argument for why they should privatize was this, is that, you know, he considered himself not a true homeowner without the ability to profit from this. And he saw a step of becoming, as you said it, you know, a person of economic substance, or really a full citizen of the United States, being able to sell this for whatever he wanted. So that's the framework in which he is operating, in which he's making this argument. The way I read it is, well, we have a real problem. I mean, we do have a real problem if you must own property in order to be a person of substance in the U.S. So mm-hmm. I think this is a way of looking at ownership as, well, you know, many people have this idea is that home ownership is the pinnacle. It is the way, it is the pathway towards, you know, stability. It's the pathway towards being able to send your kids to college. It's the way to fund elder care for your parents who are getting older. It's this mechanism that's supposed to serve all of these purposes that are beyond actually being a home. It's supposed to serve as an asset and an investment and a commodity in many senses. And so I think that this perspective of what homeownership should be is just skewed. I mean, if we're laying at homeownership's feet the need to address all of these different issues, which are, you know, their health issues, their, you know, education issues, all of that, it can't do all of those things and still be affordable. So yeah. There's also this piece here where it's like, you know, I'm a renter in New York is still a city of renters. Mm-hmm. I think it will always be, you know, there it will always be a majority renter city. And the idea that one can't be a person of substance unless they like own property is a way of writing off a significant portion of the populace who aren't going to achieve that. And in many cases, it doesn't make financial sense for them to do so. So I see this idea, which is very central to Americans' ideas of housing, as being itself a really harmful narrative that we need to get over in order to make sure that people are able to be, you know, safely, stably, affordably housed across the country.
The book really does raise a lot of really interesting issues along the lines that we've just been discussing. The book is Homes for Living, author Jonathan Tarleton. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Here in the KPC studios, we have the market ticker up on the big screen. Now, you may be like us, or maybe you just let it be because you're not trading on a daily basis. Regardless of how you look at it, the stock markets around the world are down. They're kind of funny. Last Monday, the S&P 500 closed at 5612. Friday, it closed at 5074. That's down 9.5%. To give us some perspective on what's happening is Will Thompson of Victrix Investment Advisors. And full disclosure, I am associated with Victrix Investment Advisors. Good morning, Will. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, great. So Victrix Investment Advisors and RIA, which is a registered investment advisory firm, is that correct?
That is right. Yes.
Good. And you obviously are monitoring the stock markets around the world as we are right here.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I think the big question is, what's happening? Do you have any perspective?
A lot of people are feeling concerned. It feels a little different, feels scary, but I have a question for you. Do you know what the best-selling candy bar was in 1965?
Best-selling 1965.
Mr. Goodbar?
Mounds.
A good guess. It was the Snickers bar.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Do you know what the best-selling candy bar is here in 2025?
Snickers.
It's easy to focus on how much things have changed or may change, but maybe we should focus more on what won't change.
Gotcha. But yeah. Isn't the Snickers bar a little bit smaller than it was back in 1965?
And it doesn't cost a nickel anymore. Before we sort of get into what won't change, let's sort of help our listeners get a perspective on how last week or the last 3 days fits into history. How big a movement is this relative to other sort of shocks and big movements that we've seen in the past?
Well, we've experienced this in recent history. You know, COVID, when those events first started to unfold for us, the market dropped 38% in just over a month. And then if you roll the clock back, we had the financial crisis, we had the dot-com. There's been any number of these over our history, and yet we've always found a way to come through. And I mentioned things not changing, and what doesn't change is kind of the entrepreneurial spirit of America, where business owners will find ways to produce goods and services that we all want and need. And so we'll get through this. And while this does feel different, just like with the Snickers bar hasn't meaningfully changed. It tastes just as good today as it did in 1965. And that's why M&M Mars still has the largest market share.
It is definitely one of my favorite candy bars. I have to rob it from my daughter's Halloween bag every year. Okay, so during COVID, you said, what was the percent, 38%?
38% top to bottom, yeah.
And how long did that take to for the entire 38% to drop out?
Just over a month. That was dramatic and fast. We hadn't seen events like that for 100 years when stock ownership was far more concentrated with the Spanish flu. And yet, by the end of the year, we are all the way back out of that hole, the 38% drop. So I don't know exactly how these events we're currently living through will play out, but history suggests that we'll be just fine and to stay the course.
And with the 38% drop, how quickly did it come back?
Before the end of the year. It was just a matter of months, and we were already back.
Gotcha. So it dropped quicker than it came back. And yes. My guess is you're just saying it happened, and just chill.
Fear happens in a blink of an eye. Confidence builds back more slowly. And so I don't know how quickly confidence will come back with the current concerns that we're facing, but it'll come back. There's a difference between price and value. Right now, what we're seeing is the prices have dropped, but I don't think the value of corporate America has meaningfully changed. And I mentioned the Snicker bar earlier. It tastes just as delicious. People are still going to buy it. It's owned by a privately traded company or privately held company, so we don't know what the value of it's done, but the price would have done if it was publicly traded. But I don't look at the price of a stock as a referendum of the value of the business. It's a question of how much cash is the business going to generate. And as long as the companies continue to generate cash, your investment is perfectly sound.
Well, let's probe into that a little, because some of the, again, it's really interesting to me that we're comparing what happens as a result of a worldwide pandemic to what's happened by the act of a single afternoon on the White House lawn. So in that sense, it is different in kind. The second thing is that at the time of the pandemic, obviously, we were seeing sort of a worldwide economic shutdown. I mean, business was coming to a halt because people weren't willing to go out and do things. Here, I think my guess, and I'm not anywhere near as sophisticated in this as you are, is that some of what's going on now is that there is a fear that as a result of what happened this week, there will be a substantial sort of break or slowdown in international trade, and that a stock like Apple will be looking at the impact of tariffs on its prices, which in turn will drive down its earnings. Isn't that a realistic way of looking at it?
Well, it's always new and it's always different. If it was routine, the stock market wouldn't react accordingly. But if you can look beyond the current events to the longer term impact, and you mentioned Apple, I'm not going to use my iPhone any less. And when it wears out, I'll buy a new one and they'll come out with new services and upgrades. So the impact of the tariffs will be not consistent across the board. It largely has to do, in my opinion, with how differentiated the product is. If you're selling iron ore, you're going to eat the cost of the tariff because your lump of iron ore is exactly the same as domestically produced iron ore. Whereas the iPhone, there just isn't a close substitute. If you want French wine, it's meaningfully different to you, so you will pay the additional tariff. You, the consumer, will pay the additional
tariff. Well, no, wait a minute. Let me stick with iron ore for a minute. I once studied economics, but it was a long time ago, and maybe I've forgotten it. But if all of a sudden my foreign iron ore producer is charging $100, they used to charge $90, now they're going to charge $100, and I can mm-hmm. still sell it for $90, why on earth am I not selling it for $99?
Domestically, you will, but then that also gets into the substitution effect. Iron ore now costs more for the manufacturer. They'll substitute. They'll either reduce the amount they need of iron, or they'll find a substitute.
My only point is that what's going to happen is highly inflationary. In other words, one of the things we've heard is that because domestic manufacturers will not bear the cost of those tariffs, the consumer is not going to get hurt badly because they'll just go to the domestic producer. And what I don't understand is why wouldn't the domestic producers raise their prices to just under what the importers are doing? And in that case, you know, the producer's not going to eat it, the consumer is.
Well, that's what I'm saying is the producers will substitute products. They'll find ways to use less of it in their whether in the example you're talking about, they find ways to use less iron, they'd improve their product. Maybe they substitute for aluminum or something similar. So that kind of puts a cap as to how much the iron ore producer will be able to raise their prices because people will substitute away. They'll find cheaper ways. So it's a supply demand and it's not necessarily static.
Gotcha. So
participants will react.
Yeah, see what you mean there. So let's go back to the iPhone. So the iPhone will be tariffed since it's made in China. And so it's going to be significantly more expensive. So maybe if you were swapping out an iPhone every 2 years, you might say, you know, I'm going to go 3 years. And could that impact the bottom line of Apple Corp?
I suspect that Apple has significant pricing power, and we see that every year because every model, yes, it's newer, fancier, faster, but the prices go up every single year. So I think it largely is dependent on how differentiated is the product in the consumer's mind. Mm-hmm. As long as it's a differentiated product in the consumer's mind, they will pay more. The companies will be able to pass on. Ultimately, tariffs are a tax. And so that will have a suppressing effect to the economy. But if you put off buying your iPhone, maybe you spend the money traveling domestically at one of the beautiful parks, skiing, for example.
That's what we want to see.
One of the national parks. People tend to spend what they have.
Well, I don't know about going to the national parks. I've heard some pretty gnarly stories about the funding cuts and how the restrooms all look. But that's not the point here. So now what about corporations like the auto business? They move things across the borders, you know, with both Canada and Mexico, you know, the U.S. automakers, constantly. You know, the part, it needs a little piece here, boom, it goes to Mexico. They do the work, it comes back, goes to Canada, it comes back and forth. And if it's getting tariffed each time, I imagine cars are going to go up significantly, and therefore the auto manufacturers' stocks will drop? What do you think?
It's certainly possible. I mean, Ford Motor Company has been around for over 100 years. GM is kind of a conglomerate. They brought together several independent manufacturers. They're going to find a way through this. And, you know, what's happened in the last 100 days really doesn't matter for a business that's been around for 100 years. And as it relates to the stock price, again, look past the short-term concerns, because if the tariffs don't work, they'll be repealed. If they do work, we're all better off. It's not, in my opinion, it's not a permanent state of affairs.
And so you're saying if the tariffs don't work, they'll be repealed? And who's going to repeal them? Congress? Since they're the ones who are supposed to be putting it in place?
That's the beautiful thing of our system is that failed policies tend to lead to new politicians.
So true. So since we talked about the iPhone, you know, Apple, automakers, what sectors of the market will thrive, if any?
I think the ones that will be harmed the least are the ones that sell differentiated products, mm-hmm. because they'll be able to pass on this new tax to consumers. Generally, those products tend to be further away from the dirt. We mentioned iron ore. One lump of iron ore is exactly the same as the next. Yes, I know there's transportation costs mm-hmm. and different grades, but by and large, it's a commodity product. And the further and further you get in the value add process, the more you're able to pass it on. So the iPhone is differentiated to those consumers. If you're going to buy a Monet, there is no substitute. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's all sorts of products that are in between. A lot of the service businesses won't be as affected. Your dry cleaner, for example, they're not competing with anyone in China. There is no tariff. Mm-hmm. You go locally.
But do they get their chemicals for the dry cleaning from China? or anywhere outside the United States? I don't know where that stuff's made. Interesting idea.
So you said if the tariffs don't work, they'll be pulled back. If they do work, we'll all be better off. That suggests, what do you think the tariffs working looks like?
It seems more like a political decision at this point. It's largely around bringing more manufacturing jobs back to the U.S.
But do we
have... Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, an easy year to remember for us Americans. And in it, he largely talks about comparative advantage. Mm-hmm. And what he said, he talked about the candle maker and the baker. They don't know each other. They don't care about each other. But the baker can produce 10 loaves of bread more efficiently than the candle maker could make one loaf for himself and his family. And through that, everyone benefited from trade. And that's what we've largely done over the last 40, 50 years as we've moved more towards a global system. We've taken advantage of comparative advantage, where it's just cheaper to manufacture certain products elsewhere.
So if it's more expensive to bring them from other countries, will we be making iPhones, you know, for example, here in the United States? And do we have the capacity to do that, do you think?
It'll be a multi-year process if we ever do. That's part of the problem, because it's not just the factory that assembles the iPhones. It's all the componentry that go into it and all the coordination associated, because if you are the battery manufacturer, you're not going to build your plant until the iPhone plant is there.
Right.
You can't make that multi-year commitment without knowing that you'll have the resulting revenue. So it takes quite a bit of coordination, which just takes time. It takes time to build buildings and factories and everything that goes into supplying those.
That's a really powerful point, and that's one that at least has made me to be a little skeptical about what you said, how it works. Because if Congress had passed a set of statutes that spoke to a tariff level, and put a time frame on it and said, okay, we're going to kick in this tariff of this percent 3 years from now, and you know, we're committed to that, and it was law, then maybe as a guy who runs a big business, I'm willing to invest in the capital necessary to build the factory. But I guess I'm wondering why, if I'm responsible to my shareholders and I know that this could be reversed tomorrow if somebody gets up in the morning and decides to reverse it, why would I invest in a factory to bring manufacturing back here when I have this incredible risk that the tariff that I'm counting on won't be there?
I completely agree with you. And again, I think it depends on the product. Is it differentiated?
Yeah.
If it's not differentiated, it gets to a comparative advantage game, and who's going to be the lowest cost producer of that good. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, Walmart used to advertise Made in America.
Yep.
And it was that little yellow happy face that would bounce around on all their ads when they were rolling back prices. Walmart doesn't advertise that anymore. At the end of the day, consumers didn't care. They just wanted the lowest price toaster they could get. But toasters are undifferentiated. And so ultimately, that's what the consumer wants. And what's being lost a little bit here is, what does human nature, mm-hmm. and what does the consumer ultimately want? And they just want the lowest cost of goods. You know, every day, 347 million Americans wake up and they're trying to do a little bit better for themselves and their family. And I think ultimately that will play out over the long term. Over the short term, there will be all sorts of disruptions and wrong turns and other things along the way. But the economic machine that is America is still intact. We still have by far the best system in the world. And that will play out over time. In fact, what I'm saying is, you don't want to bet against America. That's been a losing bet for 250 years. And I think it will continue to be.
Gotcha. So we just have a little bit of a burp in the market right now that we have to just fasten our seatbelts, put on a crash helmet, and muscle it out.
That's why stocks offer such an attractive return over time. It's because of times like this. It's not because everything's smooth and steady. CDs or money market funds are smooth and steady, but you make hardly any return as a result. It's the feeling that you're getting right now that is why you get such an attractive return over time in stocks.
And that goes to the point that I know, you know, some people are looking at this and going, God, should I get out, right? I mean, I just really don't want to lose any more money. Talk a little bit about how difficult it is to time the market and what history tells us about what happens if you get out at the dip and how if you only miss a few days, what it does to your return.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That feels good. And there seems to be intuitive appeal to it. But if you look from 1990 through the end of 2020, so 31 years, if you missed just the five best days over those 31 years, you had 37% less money.
Mm-hmm.
5 days over 31 years. And so that's the concern, is in those days tend to happen during times like this when people are feeling the most uncertain.
Well, excellent.
So the allure of just stopping the pain by getting out turns out to be very, very expensive.
Very expensive, right. Well, we've just spent a few minutes with Will Thompson of Victrix Investment Advisors. Will, thank you very much for your time. Maybe we'll get you back when the market bounces back and we can all have a shot of whiskey together.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day.
Right.
Thanks, you too.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.